Good afternoon. My name is Heidi, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Town Hall Investment Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. If you should need assistance during the call, please press star, then zero on your telephone keypad, and an operator will come back to assist you. Thank you. Judy Bricker, Director of Corporate Marketing, you may begin your conference.
Thank you. Welcome to our listeners from the Sanibel Captiva Trust Company and its divisions of the Naples Trust Company and the Tampa Bay Trust Company. As a reminder, information presented today is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities product, service, or investment strategy. Investments involve risk, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with your qualified financial advisor, tax professional, or attorney before implementing any strategy or recommendation discussed during this call. I'm joined today by Ian Bruch, Chief Investment Officer, and Tim Vick, Director of Research for the Trust Company, who will be answering questions primarily sent in by our clients. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Judy.
Good afternoon.
We have quite a few questions today, so let's just jump into it. The second quarter of 2017 seemed to be a continuation of the trends, with the market up another 3%, and the market has advanced even more since the end of June. What's driving this?
Well, thank you, Judy. I'll take that one. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Tim. And I think the first thing we need to just constantly remember is that stock prices ultimately follow corporate sales and profits. That is the biggest driver of where stocks are going near term. And if corporate profits and sales are rising, so will the stocks and vice versa. And that really is the trend we've been focusing on for really more than a year, because long before the election, we started seeing some uptick in corporate sales, some corporate returns on capital that indicated to us that the economies were on more solid footing, and that corporate profits were really going to start accelerating into late 2016 and into this year, despite who was going to win the election. And that's something you have to key in on as well, that we were coming out of about a five-quarter recession of profits, led mostly by oil companies and banks whose earnings and margins had dropped drastically, and now they're accelerating again. And we've seen some very good numbers out of a lot of companies over the last two or three quarters that really has justified this rally in the market. You know, I think of companies like Google, whose earnings are supposed to rise about 35% this year, Lowe's, Home Depot, two of our favorite discretionary consumer companies. I think their earnings are going to rise about 14% this year. Bank America's earnings are up 20%. Johnson & Johnson's earnings up 20%. A lot of good positive trends that really have to do with the macroeconomic climate more than anything that's coming out of Washington. So, you know, as we see it, the rally we've seen up until a couple days ago has really been justified.
Are you concerned at all about valuation levels or their bullishness among investors?
Yeah, no, not particularly, Judy. And I say that while also admitting that valuation levels are a bit stretched in certain areas, but not at a level of real concern. We're about a year and a half out from the beginning of 2016 when we did have a bit of a market correction. I think January, February of 2016, markets were down 10 to 11% for a very short period of time. And since then, before the election, post-election, and well into this year, the markets have really been straight up. So I think after a period of time, it's just a natural question to ask, where are we in the market? Where are valuation levels? And we're not at a super high level. We're at about 20 times earnings, which is consistent with where we've been hovering now for well over a year. When you compare that to the price multiple on fixed income, for example, we still see stocks as a far better value versus traditional fixed income, and it's not at a valuation level that's overly worrisome.
What about the market's breadth, Ian? The large technology stocks have been driving returns. Does the market's rally seem healthy to you?
Well, tech has gotten a lot of press this year for good reason. It is up quite a bit. I think technology as a sector is up over 18% year-to-date, which is strong. I just remind everyone that it had a pretty poor year last year, and so that's just sort of the nature of things. Things don't do well, and then all of a sudden they do well. But to get to your broader point about market breadth, I think it's fairly healthy. I mean, consumer discretionary, healthcare, utilities, those are all market sectors that are actually up double digits as well this year. Really the only sour spot, the only poor area of the market year to date has been energy. So is it healthy? I mean, I think some of the rally has certainly been justified. And when I say that, I mean, as long as revenue and earnings are growing, that's certainly a justification for a market rally, and we've seen that. but certainly some has been more speculative, and we can tie that back to the election. We did some presentations that we called the Trump effect earlier in the year, where we highlighted the fact that financials and industrials rose really dramatically, and a lot of that was just based on speculation around new policy. So I'd say overall, yes, I think the market rally has been fairly healthy.
Now for a couple of questions about politics and Washington. First, how do you think we'll be affected by the situation with Korea?
Well, I'll take a stab at that, Judy, and this is Tim again. I've been in this business a long time, and one of the things I've learned is, you know, when it comes to politics, there's a couple things you can never hedge or try to handicap, and one is a war of words between politicians, and the other is brinkmanship. You just can't figure out what's going to happen next, and certainly none of us have any extra prescience about what's going on in the mind of the Korean leaders. But you can see from the market's reaction, especially today, that investors are starting to take the rhetoric seriously, but they're still not taking it literally, and I think that's important to understand too. It's just rhetoric. You take it seriously to the extent that it may impact something in the future, but you don't always take it literally. And we've gotten used to inflammatory rhetoric coming out of North Korean leaders for two generations now, and the only difference today is that rhetoric is being matched word for word by inflammatory rhetoric coming from our own president, which seems odd to, you know, a lot of people who observe this. But, you know, that type of rhetoric doesn't change the fact that neither side really is incentivized to initiate conflict. I think they're just playing to their base. We hope that they're playing to their base, and we'll just see how that plays out. If we're trying to just reassure investors, you know, that you know, this is not the powder keg that people might think, I would just remind folks of a couple factors. And when it comes to rhetoric, you know, history has shown that 95-97% of the time, the rhetoric leads to absolutely nothing except more war of words. And we think that's likely the scenario is going to play out here. And then second, if some sort of conflict arises out of this, some tangible conflict, the market tends to discount it pretty quickly. Whether it was a terrorist attack, whether it was minor skirmishes around the world, whether it was September 11th, the market discounted the impact on companies, discounted the impact on the economy, determined that these were more one-off situations that weren't going to impact our livelihoods for very long, and certainly wasn't going to impact business sales and profits for very long. So you would see a minor correction in the market for a while, and then we'd be back to normal. And, you know, if a situation should boil over here and escalate, we would expect that kind of scenario to play out.
We're heading for another confrontation on the debt ceiling. Can you explain why the debt ceiling is important?
Sure. Just for a little background, anytime the U.S. government runs a deficit, it has to borrow. It has to borrow money to pay those bills, and it borrows by issuing bonds. And the way the process is set up now is that Congress sets a limit as to how much the U.S. Treasury can borrow. And when the Treasury gets up to that limit, they must go back to Congress and get reauthorization to raise what's called the debt ceiling. And in a couple more months, in actually September or October, the U.S. Treasury is going to come up against that limit and will need to continue to borrow money and will need reauthorization from Congress. Well, for the last 6 or 7 years now, this has become kind of a political football where particularly members of the Republican Party have tried to tie raising the debt ceiling to budget cuts. And it has brought us to the point of brinkmanship a couple times. In 2011, the Republicans took this whole debt ceiling issue to the 12th hour, and we lost our credit rating temporarily, and we saw interest rates move up a little bit. So hopefully our politicians have learned their lesson, and as they did in 2011, they kissed and made up, and we kept raising the debt ceiling. I suspect that this time around, knowing what happened in 2011, that none of our politicians want to see the debt ceiling fail, and that we want Congress to raise the debt ceiling. It'd be inconceivable if they didn't, and we don't want to see higher interest rates. We don't want to see a loss of credit rating. We don't want to see other economic situations arise unnecessarily because Congress just didn't act on this pretty simple issue.
Regarding tax reform, have investors given up expecting lower tax rates? What do you see happening here by the end of the year?
Well, certainly the expectations for lower rates have dropped pretty significantly the last several weeks, and expectations were very high right after the election that we would get corporate tax reform and individual tax reform very quickly. But after seeing the inaction from Congress on things like health care, I think the market's getting more skeptical that we'll get any action. In terms of the tax reform, a lot of things hinged on what was called this border adjustment tax, which Congress tried to run through about a month ago, and it failed, and it basically would have raised taxes on imports into this country for a lot of just tens of thousands of products. And that border tax was needed to offset tax cuts that were being proposed elsewhere. And that's the rule that Congress has to live under now, is that if you're going to have tax cuts in one part of the economy or one part of the electorate, it has to be offset by tax increases somewhere else. So this has kind of put them in a quandary temporarily, because if they couldn't get the border tax implemented, it's going to be real hard to reduce federal tax rates for individuals and corporations. If I were a betting person right now, I would say that the Republicans will have to regroup when they come back after their August recess and go after what's simple, which is possibly eliminating the estate tax and lower the corporate tax rate, which is now 35%. If they can get that down to 15 or 20 or even 25, that's a measure of relief for a lot of companies. And then see if they can come up with some bipartisan bill that would streamline the tax code for all. But Congress has only a couple months now to put in some sort of tax reform that could be retroactive to January 1st, and we still think there's a better than 50% chance they can do it.
Okay. Turning to economics, Ian, what do you see as the pluses and minuses for our economy? Are we at risk at all of a recession?
Well, I'd say no. On the positive side, I think there's much more to be positive about. The unemployment picture continues to improve. We're starting to see a bit of wage inflation for the first time in a long time, which you would expect to see given where we are with unemployment. GDP growth continues to grow, maybe not at the rate that certainly Trump would like and many would like, but it's still moving in the right direction. Consumer confidence increasing, housing, we're still building, supplies coming down. Industrial production is improving. So most of the major economic data points are moving in the right direction. I think the one wild card continues to be interest rates and where they're headed. So monetary policy is certainly going to affect that. You know, if we do get into a higher interest rate environment, the market will react. But that's really the one sort of unknown, I would say. Are we at risk of recession was the second part of the question.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say no, given the backdrop of the positive economic data. Now, we did spend some time earlier talking about we're about a year and a half away now from the most recent correction. There's a big difference between a market correction and a recession. Market corrections happen quite often. They're actually a pretty healthy part of an otherwise upward-moving market. A recession is tied more to sluggish GDP growth, which we're just not seeing. So I think a recession is far less likely than maybe a correction over the next 3 to 6 months.
Okay. It looks like the U.S. dollar has started to weaken. Why is that, Tim, and what impact is that having on portfolios?
Well, the key thing is the U.S. dollar is weakening not because of something that's happening here in the United States, but what's happening abroad, and that is we're seeing a kind of coordinated GDP growth in places like Europe and in Asia and Japan, where these economies had been stagnating for 3 or 4 years now, and now we're starting to see signs that maybe their GDP growth could be 1%, 1.5%, 2%, certainly a lot better than what we've seen in the past. And that strengthening has really reversed what had been a 3 or 4 year trend where the dollar just, you know, gained materially against all our trading partners. And, you know, how big an impact is this going to be? I think it's going to be pretty big. We're starting to see a little bit of this impact roll off into the quarterly earnings numbers for the second quarter, but you know, when I looked just this morning, Canadian dollar, I think, was up about 6% year-to-date against the U.S. dollar. The euro was up about 11%. The Mexican peso was up about 14 or 15%. Those are big numbers in a short period of time. And I mentioned those three currencies because those are our three biggest trading zones. Our companies export about 50% of our goods to those three areas. So if there's a net gain in those currencies of, you know, on average 10%, that's a 10% boost that our companies are getting on their sales and bottom line from the currency translation, and that's going to start translating to better profits and sales for our companies who are exporting here in the third and fourth quarter. So it's a good trend and something we've wanted to see for a couple of years, and frankly, it's welcome.
How many more times do you think the Federal Reserve will boost interest rates now?
Well, we said in our last newsletter that we felt the Federal Reserve was poised to do four rate increases totaling about 1 percentage point over the next 24 months. And we haven't seen anything since we wrote that letter in June that would, you know, reverse our stance on that. We're still cautious long-term about what the Fed can ultimately do with rates, because you still have interest rates near zero or certainly less than 1% in a lot of pockets of the world. So we can't make our U.S. dollar and our interest rates uncompetitive against the rest of the world. And we certainly can't raise rates quickly and at a high level to the extent that it will cause the financing costs of state and local and even our federal government to rise substantially. If you raise interest rates in the United States 100 basis points or 1% or even 2% over the next couple of years, you've raised the interest cost to all our governments collectively $200 or $300 billion a year. And that's money that won't be put into discretionary items there or entitlement spending. That's money that has to be reserved just to make interest payments. So there is a natural ceiling, we believe, on how much interest rates can rise. But we think the Federal Reserve, now having liquefied and re-energized the balance sheets of banks and consumers, are in a position now to get rates back to a normal level. And they've signaled they're going to do it slowly. And we think that's the best course.
Ian, will rising interest rates hurt stock values over time?
Well, I think that the key words to your question are over time. And I'd say, you know, if that assumes a longer time frame, no. I mean, rising interest rates are actually a positive economic data point. It typically means that the Fed feels comfortable raising interest rates. So that means unemployment's at a lower level. We're seeing some inflation in the market, which I think everyone would welcome at this point. In the short term, however, yes, I mean, certainly rising interest rates are going to hurt some stocks as market participants sort of readjust to what's going on. We've seen that, you know, when the Fed's made decision to raise rates, sometimes the market just accepts it and moves on, and sometimes you get sell-offs in some of the dividend-paying companies or the higher-yielding investments. But again, those are very short-term movements. So if you're a trader, I'd say be concerned. If you're a long-term investor, I think that's you know, we would welcome a long-term trend in rising interest rates.
How have fixed income and high-yielding investments done this year? Are you repositioning for higher rates?
Well, I'll start with fixed income. Traditional bonds, if we just assume that's the Barclays Aggregate Bond Index, which is an index that's similar to the S&P 500, but for bonds, that's up between 2 and 3% this year, right in line with the yield on those bonds. Our high-income portfolio, which is really our alternative to traditional bonds, is up around 6% this year. Again, very close to what the stated yield on that strategy is. So I'd say fixed income and higher-yielding investments have really done what we would expect them to do so far this year. Are we repositioning for higher rates? No, and that's basically because, you know, we have to remember that most of our positioning is really tied back to our individual clients' return goals, all of which are different and unique. And so if we have clients, many of which live off their portfolio and need 3 to 4% a year, we're certainly not going to reposition a portfolio because interest rates are moving higher. Now, with that said, we do think about, at the individual security level, how do we protect against inflation over time? And if you're going to own a higher-yielding investment that's, let's call it 3 to 4%, what we like to see is investments that are also growing that distribution or that dividend by another 3 to 4% every year. That there's a natural inflation hedge built in there. That's something you don't get with a traditional bond, which is why we've avoided them when we can. So that leads us into other places like master limited partnerships, real estate investment trusts, preferred stocks to a lesser extent. Utilities fall in that space as well. Anything that's publicly traded that has a distribution yield that can grow over time is what we would look for. We think that will hold up better in a rising interest rate environment.
Tim, one client asked specifically if preferred stocks are a safe haven to ride out all the dysfunction in Washington. How did preferreds hold up in the 2008 Great Recession?
Well, that's an excellent question. In a normal economic climate, and I have to stress normal, you would expect that preferred stocks are going to hold their value, because in a normal type of recession or a dysfunctionary environment that maybe creates a recession, interest rates tend to fall, and that really elevates or at least holds up the value of a lot of fixed income investments like Ian just referred to, everything from utilities to preferreds and such. And that would be a normal environment. Now, 2008-2009 was much, much different, as we all know and experienced, and hopefully something we don't see again in our investing lifetime. The difference was in 2008, 2009, the companies causing the dysfunction were the banking stocks, and the banks were the largest issuer of preferred stocks. And to the extent that investors were worried about the leverage position and the financial distress of the banks, they not only knocked the common stocks down, they knocked the preferreds down incredibly as well. Well, many preferreds trade at a par value of $25 and had been hovering around $25 before the Great Recession, and some of them fell to well under $20, some as far as $10 or $12, but they maintained their distributions. So instead of yielding 6% at a $25 price, they were yielding 12% or higher, or 14% at $12, and it was a great buying opportunity, but you suffered a lot of loss of principal and loss of value for a couple of years while the investing public regained their confidence in the banks. We don't think that would we're going to see that again in our lifetime, where the banking system is pushed to that type of brink. There might be in the future some new catalyst during a recession that might cause underlying common stocks to really decline and pull down preferreds with them. But, you know, we learned lessons, too, that if you're going to study preferred stocks, you have to study the underlying company first, make sure they can maintain their cash flows in a weakened environment, whether that's being caused by Washington or not. And then you have to keep an eye on interest rates. If interest rates fall, we would expect the values of preferred stocks to at least hold their value, if not rise. And if interest rates start rising, we would expect the preferreds, at least the ones that can't be called, would decline in price.
How do companies fare in their latest earnings reports, and what were the biggest surprises, good or bad?
Well, actually, we've reviewed more than 100 earnings reports now over the last couple of weeks, and we're feeling pretty good by what we saw. We've noticed, and we were looking at the numbers a couple of days ago, about 71% of all our companies reported beat their estimates in terms of earnings, and quite a few of them raised their earnings guidance for the rest of 2017, and a few actually extended out into 2018 and said that their earnings were going to be a little higher than expected. And that is a trend we've seen industry-wide, that the S&P 500 companies right now, of them that have reported, I think about 72% have beat their estimates. And the typical company that we're seeing right now is beating on earnings, and they're mostly hitting their revenue targets. Sometimes they're missing the revenues by 1% or so, but they're real close on revenues, and they're beating on the earnings, which tells me that their margins are improving. And if their margins are improving, the returns on capital and equity are improving, those are good signals that we like to see. Of course, we've had good and bad pockets in there. The retailers have disappointed everybody. We've seen a couple retail stocks that just got hit very hard when they posted same-store sales growth that was not up to the market's liking, and we thought, in some respects, that was justified because going into the earnings report, they were trading at very inflated price-earnings ratios. On the other hand, we saw a lot of consumer products names like Johnson & Johnson, Diageo, you know, give us very quintessential reports as to what's happening in corporate America. Diageo, which is one of our favorite European stocks, I believe they had 15% sales growth in the last quarter. Their operating profits and cash flows were up about 25%. They're buying back $1.5 billion worth of stock. They guided that their sales growth should come in around 4 to 5, 6% this year. That's ideal, and that's very typical of what we're seeing right now.
We have more questions on specific companies. Ian, first, what are the prospects for Enbridge after it merged with Spectra Energy?
Yeah, well, this deal closed first quarter of 2017 here, so they're now combined. And it was really a deal done out of strength, in our opinion. So we are holders of Enbridge. We continue to buy it. The deal really diversified the asset base between both natural gas and liquid oil pipelines. They've doubled their growth budget over the next several years, so that's a key component to keeping their distribution growth high. We think they'll do a nice job of reducing debt in the coming years. They expect to grow their dividend north of 10% through 2024, which is a pretty astounding number in our opinion. And the payout ratio we expect to remain in the 50 to 60% range, which is rather conservative. So Enbridge today yields about 4.2%, and considering we expect them to grow their distribution double digits over the next several years, we're happy to continue to invest money there.
With the coal and nuclear power industries disrupted lately, what do you like among utilities?
Well, within utilities, we try to keep things fairly simple. We like the big regulated players today. I think our largest positions are in Southern, Duke Energy, and Public Service, or PEG is the ticker, all of which yield right around 4%. They're regulated utilities, so their revenue and earnings out over the course of the next few years are fairly predictable. And their distribution growth should average between 3 and 5% as well. So we buy and own utilities for the income primarily. We're not trying to hit home runs in the utility space, that's for sure. Another name that we like that's on our approved list that we don't own much of today, just given valuation, is NextEra Energy. They own Florida Power and Light. They yield about 2.5%, but just given where they're valued, we're not adding new dollars there. But it's a fantastic company and one that falls more in that growth area of the utility market.
We have another question on General Electric. Tim, can the new CEO right the ship?
I think the new CEO, John Flannery, who took over August 1st, is going to have a little bit more difficult time than maybe some investors might have speculated. General Electric is a very large ship that's going to be hard to turn around. They've gone through essentially 10 to 12 years of restructuring, asset sales, divestitures, even a spinoff of NASA. They've acquired new lines of businesses. So they've done a lot of strategic things already to try to improve value to shareholders. And yet we have a stock that's been languishing between $25 and $32 for the better part of 5 years now. We've been following the company for about 12 years now. We have a fair value on it at around 30, so we think it's undervalued right now. We're just going to give the new CEO some more time, but we understand that there's not a lot he can do near term other than spin off some businesses and try to extract some value that way, because we've got to think that the folks at General Electric, the board of directors plus Jeff Immelt, the outgoing CEO, probably tried everything already in their toolbox to try to improve value, and there's not much left for John Flannery to do here.
Moving to healthcare, with Obamacare in limbo, what are your concerns for healthcare stocks and drug stocks?
Well, in the drug industry or healthcare, this is another industry we're not going to try to handicap based on what we think Washington might pass or might not pass in the coming months. We learned the lesson back in 2009 that those people who try to handicap what would happen with healthcare under Obamacare really got it wrong. And I think just misplaced and misinterpreted some trends that were developing. When we look at healthcare or drug stocks right now, we're looking first and foremost at sales growth. The entire pie of healthcare spending is still growing, no matter what happens in Washington. The amount of dollars that's going to be consumed by healthcare, the per capita consumption of healthcare, the amount of federal spending that's going to go to healthcare is just going to keep increasing. It may increase at higher or lower rates, but it's going to keep increasing. So the first thing you got to look at is companies that are growing, whether they're healthcare companies, and if we're studying things like Pfizer or Lilly or Novartis or Roche, we're going to be looking at pipeline. We're going to be looking at how sustainable is their current roster of drugs that are out there. What's the bottom line demand for them? How fast is that demand going to grow? And then we'll make minor calculations in the future as to whether or not Washington's policies are going to impact the margins of those drugs. But if you get top line growth to begin with, I think that's the best thing you can hope for, and that's how we're going to look at that industry.
Warren Buffett made news over the weekend when it was revealed that Berkshire Hathaway is sitting on $100 billion in cash. How do you interpret that, and is Berkshire still attractive?
Well, as someone who's been following Berkshire for 15 or 20 years, this was a day that was coming because the company was going to keep getting larger. Its float and its cash flows from its businesses were going to keep getting larger, and the $100 billion is just a number at this point, but it reflects a fact positively, I think, that Warren Buffett has a lot of ammunition at his disposal to put to work. And we've seen for many, many years that when he does finally put money to work, it's very profitable for investors. He raises the value of the company. Now, that $100 billion eventually, I think, is going to return a nice return for investors. And we did a fair value analysis, kind of a sum of the parts of Berkshire last week, and we thought that just by some moves he made by deploying cash in the last 6-9 months, he's raised the fair value of the B shares to about $180 a share, and that's what the stock trades for pretty much.
Ian, are companies finally starting to put their cash to work? And if so, are you concerned at all that dividend increases and share buybacks might stop?
Well, they are spending money, but I would say no. We're not really concerned because as long as companies continue to invest in net present value projects, positive net present value projects, that increase over time, they should be fine. So positive returns on capital, positive earnings lead to dividend increases and continued share buybacks. I'd also say that, you know, there's a lot of cash that remains parked offshore. That's another policy item that remains out there. If that comes stateside in any way, shape, or form, that'll be beneficial to the shareholder class as well.
I'm going to squeeze in one more question. I know you both are watching Europe and emerging markets. Why have those markets rallied so much?
Well, I think for years, particularly Europe and other developed parts of the world, they've been a little undervalued versus our market here, and that's really been because coming out of the Great Recession, it took them a little bit longer to get their feet back under them than it did here in the U.S. So Europe has been more attractively valued for a while now, and I think we're seeing some of that be erased here in the first half of the years. Europe has done quite well. Other developed portions of the world have done quite well this year, and I think that's just a function of valuation catching up. On the emerging market side, that's an area where we're avoiding still. There's a lot of risks in those markets still today. So we do focus, when we do go outside of the United States, we try to stay developed. We own a lot of large businesses, primarily in Europe, and I think Tim alluded to Diageo. That's one that's located overseas. We also have a few Swiss pharmaceutical companies. So we're not opposed to owning some international assets.
Ian and Tim, thank you for your insights today.
Thank you, Judy.
From all of our teams from Tampa Bay to Marco Island, we thank you for attending today's call. If you'd like to listen again at your leisure, the link will be available on our website under Investment News. Have a good evening, and thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.